You might remember the director Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck as the man who made the crossover hit about a Stasi officer who spies on a playwright, The Lives of Others, back in 2006, which went on to win the Oscar for Best Foreign Film. He's since made a film called The Tourist in 2010, but the star power of Angelina Jolie and Johnny Depp, not to mention the beauty of Venice, was not enough to save it from savage reviews. Well, for his third film, Never Look Away, he takes us back to Germany to tell a captivating, earnest and very grand tale about the making of an artistic genius, the Dresden-born German artist Gerhard Richter. Though this is very far from an endorsed biopic, a New Yorker profile of the filmmaker from the beginning of the year reported that the notoriously private Richter had definitively distanced himself from the film, despite initially allowing Donnersmarck into his life to research it. But as you're about to hear, the film is very upfront about being a work of fiction, to the point where the protagonist isn't actually called Richter, and he's played by a blonde, handsome Tom Schilling. The name of the character is Kurt Barnett, and the performance, he's the kind of actor who can walk with the poise of a ballet dancer while wearing East German dungarees. There's something very romanticized about him. The film deals with the complex way that people come to terms with traumatic experiences, using Richter as inspiration for how he survived the war and channeled his experiences into his work, particularly during his early career, where, while studying in Dusseldorf, he began faithfully reproducing black and white photographs with a blurred effect that evoked the suggestion of memory and subjectivity. Now, many of the people in these early artworks have been the subject of intense speculation, given Richter's notorious reluctance to reveal much of his private life. But one particular image, a family snapshot featuring Richter as a child with his mentally ill aunt who died at the hands of the Nazis, becomes a key plot device in Never Look Away. The trauma of her story simmers away, unresolved for a lot of the film, in the background, as a more outlandish plot unfolds before our eyes. And that plot features one of the most bizarre on-screen villains I've seen in ages, a father-in-law gynecologist and Nazi war criminal who ingeniously reinvents himself after the war to evade justice. The smouldering Sebastian Koch, who played the playwright in The Lives of Others, is this villain, arrogant and vain in the role, except for a telling moment where he encounters his son-in-law's art and cowers away from the canvas like Nosferatu escaping the morning sun. It is indeed a very juicy villain, enhanced by the contrasting presence of a thoughtful Paula Beer, who you might remember from films like Transit and Ozon's film Franz, who plays the daughter and the wife in the film. Now, for all of its gripping wartime melodrama, and this is a three-hour film in which I was completely captivated, and the compelling theme of art's ability to console us in the face of the most heinous crimes, you might wonder, is this history? Does it matter? A reminder that The Lives of Others was criticised by many who claimed that a Stasi officer could never have acted so heroically in real life. Here's a clip from Never Look Away, and then Donnersmarck on the phone from the US.
Glaub mir, es stimmt alles nicht, was ich da gemalt habe.
Dein Schwiegervater?
Das ist nicht die Erbmasse, die ich unseren Nachkommen wünsche.
Kann er uns nicht einfach in Ruhe lassen?
Voraus.
Indem ihr euch frei macht, macht ihr die Welt frei.
Well, Florian Henkel van Donnersmarck, welcome to the Screen Show.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be there, Jason.
Now, the obvious question, I suppose, is why is this a film about Kurt Barnett? You know, it's highly inspired by Richter, but you've chosen to, I guess, fictionalize this protagonist a little bit more than what would be common in the standard biopic.
Well, I mean, I always feel like with biopics, if you find a biopic that's really true to fact, it's usually a pretty boring biopic. And so, either people stay very true to fact and they, are boring, or they stray from the facts and basically make a fictional film like I have and still decide to call it a biography. And I always think that's unfair, because then people think, oh, this is exactly what happened. And it actually isn't. It's, you know, some screenwriter inventing it. So I knew from the start that I was inspired by a few elements from the life of Gerhard Richter, but would take enough liberties to make it a necessity to call the character something else.
I'm interested to know what the relationship is between then the actual facts of the story of Richter and the fiction of the story of the person based on Richter that you've invented for the film, Kurt Barnett. I mean, mm-hmm. in terms of the family, the father-in-law, the Nazi gynecologist, I mean, what's true and what's not true? What are we to believe? Or is that not important?
Well, the thing is, I can tell you what's true for all the things that are already a matter of record that have been written in other biographies or in articles about Richter. But my agreement with him was specifically, it was a handshake agreement, that I would not reveal what was true where I knew it only from the conversations that I had with him and the recorded conversations. He would record all of them. And in turn, he would not reveal what was not true, what was invented. So, it should remain for people to speculate about. You know, it should remain a mystery, kind of like in his paintings.
Your debut feature, The Wonderful The Lives of Others, was mm-hmm. such an amazing and very moving portrait of life in East Germany.
Thank you.
And, you know, the Stasi. And in this film, you have the father-in-law, Professor Karl Seeband, played by Sebastian Koch, who is this Nazi figure who then recycles himself in East Germany after the war. Mm-hmm. Quite the villain. I mean, he is quite an extraordinary character on screen and a wonderful sort of antagonist, I suppose, in this film. Describe the character.
You know, Karl Seeband, he's someone who thinks that by being more intelligent than others, he's also a more valuable human being. You know, he's healthier, he's smarter than anyone else, and therefore considers everybody else inferior. And it's his philosophy. He says, he once expresses it even at one point in the film, he says, it's not enough to be one of the best. If you really want safety and security in life, you have to be the best. Not one of the best, only those will survive. And he uses even the Nazi era where he was one of the criminals, he uses it as an example to say, look, the very, very best, they survived. You know, whether they were enemies of the state, whether they were Jewish, they will find a way to bring Sigmund Freud out of the country or, you know, Bertolt Brecht or, you know, whomever. But if you're one of the best, you will still get murdered. And, so that's his philosophy. So his drive to survival has been commuted into a desire to be the very best at what he does, which in his case is a gynecologist. But of course, you know, as a doctor with incredible skills, but no moral compass, you're a fantastic instrument for evil.
But there is this clear idea in this film that through his character, a certain portion of the Nazi elite were able to recycle themselves and become a new elite in East Germany. Was that very common?
No. Oh, you know what? I mean, I think the very ruthlessness that allows these people to rise to the top in a Nazi regime will allow them to rise to the top in a subsequent regime and hide their crimes. I mean, it's been like that in all of history. Maybe the most visible people will be eliminated, but even just, you know, half a step beneath them, they all survive into the next system. You know, one of the particularly sinister figures, for instance, in the communist dictatorship in East Germany, was Gregor Gysi, you know, really a truly villainous character. And, you know, he's now emerged as an incredibly successful lawyer in the West and still the head of the far-left party. You know, these people have a kind of survival instinct that nothing can come up against. And that's the kind of character that I wanted to build here, describe.
It's very difficult, I think, for filmmakers to capture the process of an artist. And I think the admirable thing that you've done in this film is that you haven't tried to be too literal in your presentation of the artistic process. And you've concentrated a little bit more on, well, much more, I think, on the psychological sort of groundswell mm-hmm. that builds mm-hmm. this particular artist, Kurt Barnett, who's a kind of fictionalized version of Gerhard Richter, that builds his worldview. And especially this particular phase, this initial phase of his art. Describe to me a little bit, if you will, this what attracted you to this particular phase of, I guess, Richter's mm-hmm. output, and why you thought this would make for compelling drama in this case.
I think my awareness of this part of the artistic process was sharpened by something that I read in Ilya Kazan's autobiography, which is really one of the greatest books about filmmaking and directing ever written, for me, the greatest book. And he describes his work with people that he considers geniuses, and this film is about an artistic genius. He talks about Marlon Brando and Elia Kazan and Tennessee Williams and all the great geniuses he works with. And he says that he found that their artistic genius, as he put it, was just the scab that had formed on the wounds that life had dealt them, mostly in early childhood. And I thought, yeah, it was a strange poetic metaphor that he used there, but somehow very true. And when I look at the people that I consider geniuses, there always is some wound, some incredible hurt, some great trauma that turned them into the incredible artists that they are. And I thought it would be an interesting cinematic exploration of someone's life where you see them hurt again and again and again. And at the end, you realize that every single little wound that was inflicted was necessary for the creation of this great art.
I'm interested if you could describe for me the impact that Richter's work that you reference in this film, the blurred images, have on you.
Yeah.
Many people try and describe Richter's work, and of course, this particular phase of his career does deal heavily with memory. But formally, it's quite simple and quite ingenious. Of course, there's this sort of photorealism that then undergoes this process of blurring. Tell me about these images and what they mean to you.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great question. I was fascinated by Richter's paintings because they're based on images that mean something to him, on photographs from his family album. And if you look at those photographs, he showed me the original photographs that he did the paintings from, there's nothing. I mean, you see a picture of a pretty or a young woman holding a little baby. You know, it's a snapshot from family album. And the interesting thing is, in Germany, all family albums look identical because after the war, everything was destroyed and people were so poor that no matter whether you were, a cook at a hospital or, someone who used to own an entire company, your photo album will look identical throughout those years.
Because everyone posed for the same, shots were very valuable, so you'd pose for the one shot you knew would be a pose that would work?
I think people were already taking snapshots and it wasn't, it wasn't kind of early photography anymore. It was just, think there was such total poverty that the wares that people could get were the same whether you were someone of former privilege or underprivileged. So, it was just people were wearing the same awful clothes and they were, had the same awful equipment in their kitchens and, had the same rickety furniture and all that. There was a kind of equalization that happened when Germany was suddenly pulverized into a desert.
I see.
What happened was he then, however, had a very personal connection to these photographs. And the interesting thing is it's not visible in the photograph, but when he copied to a canvas this photograph, somehow in an almost supernatural artistic way, every emotion that he has about the photograph was translated to the canvas with every stroke of his brush. And even if it's a very faithful rendition of the photograph, suddenly you see this painting, which is an exact copy of the photograph, and it's charged with everything that the artist feels about this photograph. I've never seen the almost supernatural charging that comes through the artistic process as clearly as I did when he showed me the original photographs that his works are based on. And what he then does in the next step is he takes these very realistically painted pictures and blurs them by creating something that in art history is called sfumato, which means kind of like a smoky, smoked quality, which is you take a little brush and you just, you take a very soft brush and just slightly brush over the canvas, throwing everything out of focus. And I think that what it does is it makes it more general. Since you no longer see so precisely whose aunt is being shown there or whose uncle or whose father and whose child, whose baby nursing at the mother's breast, you can suddenly see your own child in it. You can suddenly see your own father, your own uncle. I think it makes it more general, more sweeping a statement, and the very personal becomes the general.
Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, the director of Never Look Away, which is currently in Australian cinemas now. That's it for another episode of The Screen Show. I'm Jason DeRosso. You can catch me on Twitter, and you can also find Lauren Carol Harris there as well. Or just catch us here, same place, same time, next week. We'll go out with some music from the soundtrack of Bong Joon-ho's Parasite. We'll be right back.